This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 45 was recorded on January 12, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Sprott Global's Rick Rule gave us a fantastic interview back in April of last year, which focused primarily on the private placement market for junior mining companies. But as lucrative as that sort of investing can be, investing in pre-revenue mining shares is risky business unless you know how to conduct a thorough due diligence review. So Rick is back with us this week as our feature interview guest, and we'll be taking a deep dive into the process that professionals use to select speculative investments in pre-revenue resource companies, with an emphasis on due diligence on both physical and intellectual capital.
And I'm Aaron Chen. The stock market has remained near all-time highs this week, despite quite a few bearish calls from market notables. So, Eric, what's the outlook for stocks here?
Well, you know, it seems like everybody is talking about this sell the inauguration view, and it seems to have become very popular. And sometimes these things kind of turn into self-fulfilling prophecies. So you wouldn't expect, if that's going to happen, to wait really until the actual inauguration, maybe the day before or something. People who are just, you know, hearing this view of sell the inauguration start their selling. Seems pretty likely to me that we would see some kind of sell-off just because there's so many people talking about it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The question is that really the beginning of a move to the downside, or is that just another Brexit or election night type of spike which ends up reversing the next day and we move to even new all-time highs? I've read a couple of people that are saying they think that the high is not in yet, and that after President Trump takes office, we're going to see a plateau or a high in the stock market, and then is the reality that the things that he wants to achieve are not so easily achieved as just wanting, then maybe after the first quarter is over or something, later in the first half, we see a top and a move down. I continue to feel that equities are overvalued here, but I'm staying on the sidelines. I'm very skeptical of this rally, but I don't dare be short here. There's a lot of bullish sentiment. Whether or not it's already priced in or if it's got further to go, I can't tell. I would say that I think the business cycle is very long in the tooth. I think a recession before 2017 is over is likely. So if I had to make a prediction about equities, it would be that the second half of 2017 is probably going to be soft for the equity market. So the first half going to be soft. It was the 2277 we saw last week on S&P E-mini futures going to be the top, and that was it. I doubt it. I think we're probably going to go a little bit higher before we see a topping process.
So crude oil took a beating earlier this week, trading below 50 spot 80 on Tuesday afternoon, but it seems to have recovered nicely back up to a 53 handle at 4 p.m. on Thursday. So Eric, what's going on with crude?
Yeah, we're just barely hanging on to that 53 handle, 53 spot 06 as we're taping the show on Thursday afternoon. It's been bizarre tape action for sure this week. There was weakness Tuesday afternoon when API reported a build on inventory, which was people, you know, of course, last week was a huge drawdown on inventory. And as I described last week, I think that drawdown may have had to do with people waiting to bring ships into port until after the first of the year for tax reasons. So API had reported a build of about 1.5 million barrels, and people thought that was a big deal. That caused prices to come crashing down. But the real big news came when DOE, the official government number, confirmed in spades that number, and a much bigger number, actually. They reported a 4.1 million barrel build on national crude oil inventories. And on top of that, there were just utterly massive builds in finished product inventories as well. A 5 million barrel increase in gasoline inventories and a huge 8.4 million barrel increase in distillate inventories. Now, you add those numbers all together, the build in crude oil plus the build in finished products, that's 17 million barrels more oil products, both pre and post refining, that are in stock in storage tanks this week than last week. 17 million barrels. That's huge. But again, I think year-end accounting games probably had a lot to do with this. Again, the game is that there was about 25 million barrels of crude oil reportedly anchored off the coast of Houston, waiting to come into port until after the first of the year, because apparently there's some kind of tax benefit to doing that. On top of all that, there was a huge jump in U.S. production. So all of these factors are very bearish factors. And the immediate result was a gap down in oil prices to retest Tuesday's lows. But then something happened. It lasted all of about 5 minutes, and all of a sudden we're off to the races to the upside. And immediately when I saw the tape, I said, okay, I know what's going on here. This looks like a repeat of an old story. You get a very, very bearish inventory number. 5 minutes later, some OPEC minister someplace comes out with some kind of story that supposedly OPEC has done something, and that ends up pushing prices in the other direction. But, you know, still, we're more than a day later now. Still no news, really, as far as I'm concerned. There is some discussion that OPEC has done what they promised they would do. I don't really look at that as news. But within 3 hours after that bearish data, we were more than a dollar higher in prices. And some people are saying that it is the increased demand expectations implied by very large inventory runs, record size inventory runs. Well, again, go back to the tax story. If they were waiting to bring a bunch of crude oil into port and they wanted to delay things until after the first of the year, it's really no surprise that suddenly after the first of the year and the first reporting week of the year, there's record large crude inventory runs. So I don't think that is an indication that 2017 is going to be a massive demand year. I think it's probably year-end accounting. But I think probably also some analysts are reaching for an explanation. I don't see the explanation for why there's been so much strength in the last couple of days. The inventory numbers definitely were bearish.
10-year Treasury yields were back down to 2.35% as of Thursday afternoon. So, Eric, anything new on the fixed income side?
Well, this must have been, what do they used to have those shows on TV, you know, the Battle of the Hollywood Stars? This was the Battle of the West Coast Bond Fund Managers this week. Bill Gross came out early in the week very authoritatively declaring that any move above 2.60 on the 10-year yield is the signal to watch. Mr. Gross says that if that happens, it means the 35-year bond bull market is over and we are entering a new secular bear market in bonds with expectations of higher interest rates and higher inflation. Now, that call, if true, has massive implications because we're talking about a complete change in investor psychology and behavior if the market really comes to accept that the 35-year bond bull market really and truly is over. So I think it was actually the very next day that Jeff Gundlach, of course, another famous bond manager with Double Line, publicly refers to Gross as a second-tier bond manager. He says, yeah, I heard something about some second-tier bond manager saying something about 2.60 on the 10-year, and he says that's nonsense, smears the call and says 3.00, that's the number, 3% on the 10-year yield. If we cross that, that's the real red line in the sand. When that's crossed, it means new secular bear market and fixed income. So look, Aaron, I don't know which of these super famous guys has got the number right, but I can tell you they're focused on exactly the right question. The question is, what is the technical signal that tells us or confirms that the 35-year bond bull market is over? I don't know who's got the number right, but once that question is answered, boy, there are very far-reaching implications because there's all kinds of behavioral changes. It means that people who used to have the attitude of, hey, I'll take my time before buying a house because interest rates just keep getting better and better, now it becomes a race. I've got to buy the house before the mortgage rates go through the roof. Or in the same thing in the corporate borrowing markets. So there's a lot of psychology and behavioral changes that could be implied if the market collectively comes to recognize this viewpoint of the 35-year bond bull market being over. So the big question on my mind, though, and boy, if there was anything that we could do to get Jeff Gundluck on the program, the question I want to ask him is, okay, Mr. First-rate, first-tier bond manager, if Bill Gross is only second tier, how is it, sir, that we get to your prediction of 6% return on the 10-year Treasury note without the United States government going bankrupt in the process? I don't see how that can happen. So the question I focus on is, at what point do we get to a situation where these guys that are predicting natural market forces are going to take us to higher yields are right? There is pressure to the downside on bond prices, to the upside on bond yields. But the result of that is all of a sudden Western governments cannot roll over and refinance their debt. We have a major problem, and I contend at that point they have no choice but to let inflation run away, because they cannot combat inflation by increasing yields in order to match it. I want to ask Rick Rule this question today, but you know, that's the big question on my mind, is when do we get to a breaking point? I'd love to get Jeff Gundluck on the program to ask him that one.
Gold has continued to hold its strength this week and seems to have picked up some steam right after Donald Trump's first press conference, you know, trading above 1,200, and we're looking at 1,195 on Thursday afternoon. So, Eric, your view on gold?
Yeah, we got briefly above 1,200. I think that the strength in gold, the sort of acceleration to the upside we've seen in the last week, has been 100% about a corresponding major dip in the dollar index. And it appears to be Donald Trump's first press conference was the big event that kicked off this sudden downside move, where we went all the way from 103 down to just barely below 101, 100 spot 90 something was the low print so far. And I personally don't see it. It seems to me, and I watched the press conference live, I didn't see anything that was a huge dollar bearish message. I think that all that it really was a lot of expectations that would be even more dollar bullish, that Trump would be even more outspoken about repatriation and pressuring companies to move their assets back on shore. He did say those things. I guess he didn't say them as strong as the market expected. But what we saw was a major dip down in the dollar index. I seized that as a buying opportunity. I was able to buy at 101 overnight. And already, as we're speaking now, we're up to 101 spot 36 again. I'm hoping that that was the bottom. I still think that there is a very strong bullish argument that Trump policies are going to press the U.S. dollar higher. The number I'm really going to watch carefully, though, for confirmation of that view is a move above about 102 spot 75. And the reason for that is, if I look at where we were before the Trump press conference and this sudden reversal, I'd like to move above the level when the press conference started and not see what could be interpreted as the beginning of a downsloping channel that might be forming here through those tops at 103 spot 81, which was back just around the first of the year. I think it was just in the very beginning of the last trading session of the old year, actually. And then there's another top, of course, at the press conference. I'd like to see that trend line violated to the upside to confirm my view, but I think we're headed higher on the dollar index, and if that happens, if I'm proven right there, I think gold has got probably a few soft patches ahead for it.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Rick Rule is the founder of Global Resources International, now Sprott Global. As Eric noted earlier, we interviewed Mr. Rule back on April 22nd, 2016, on the subject of private placements in mining companies. That interview is as relevant today as the day we taped it, so our accredited investor listeners in particular should consider going back and listening to that interview if they missed it in April. Eric, what will you and Rick be covering this week?
Well, obviously, you don't want to miss a chance to interview a top-notch guest like Rick Rule. So when we had the chance to get him on the schedule, we wanted to seize it. But, you know, the whole charter of Macro Voices is to strive to address a sophisticated investor audience. And I just didn't want to do yet another garden variety precious metals interview with gold and silver. And, you know, you can buy them in an ETF, or you can buy the mining shares instead. And that might be a good idea. Folks, you've heard that interview so many times over on so many different podcasts. So what we're going to do this time is we'll start with a quick precious metals market summary, the kind of stuff that you'd hear in a garden variety gold and silver interview. But from there, we're going to take a deep dive into the investment process that professionals use in order to select pre-revenue resource companies, such as junior mining companies. Because the investment process that you use when you're dealing with well-established firms, now you're looking at balance sheet ratios and so forth, you can't do that when you're really talking more about ideas than actual operating companies. So we're going to talk about investment process in due diligence in detail. And I'd really like to ask our listeners for feedback on this approach. What I'm trying to do here is make this more interesting for sophisticated investors than the usual gold and silver interview. I don't know if we're going too far in that direction or not far enough. So please, on our listener discussion forums or on Twitter, whatever, let us know how you like this format. We're going to try to give you a combination, a high-level overview of the market, and then really go deep into the process that Rick's company uses in order to select speculative investments in the natural resources sector.
Eric's interview with Mr. Rule is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Returning for a second interview is Sprott Global's Rick Rule, founder of Global Resource International, now Sprott Global. And, of course, Rick, last time you were on the program, we did a great interview about private placements in gold and silver mining companies, which was very popular with our accredited investor audience. This time, I'd like to go a little bit deeper into the subject of due diligence and just how you go through this process of investing in these pre-revenue resource companies. But, you know, I think that we would have a mutiny if my listeners found out that we had Rick Rule in the program and we didn't start with just an outlook on precious metals. So here we are after the election. There was a big run-up to election night, and there's really been downhill since until about, it looks like the bottom was right around the Fed's rate hike, and we're seeing a recovery back finally above 1,200 this morning on gold. What's going on here? What's your outlook for precious metals?
Well, at the risk of disappointing people who either hate Trump or love Trump, I think Trump is ultimately a sideshow with regards to precious metals pricing. I think the strong emotions that Trump raises in people, both pro and con, end up being fodder for a narrative. But I think ultimately he is fairly unimportant with regards to the gold price. I think what is important to the gold price is the perception and the reality of real yield on competing instruments, particularly the U.S. 10-year Treasury. You will note, as an example, that the Fed raised the interest rate by 25 basis points, but the market raised the interest rate on the U.S. 10-year Treasury by 100 basis points, which says something about inflationary expectations. The truth is that the gold price equates very well over the last 35 years to the market's perception of the real yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury. If it looks like the U.S. 10-year Treasury is a competing place to store capital during times of fear, it does better than the gold price. I believe that 2017 will resemble the market conditions that we saw in 1975, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and in 2002. In both of those years, unusually, the gold price and the U.S. dollar were both strong, mostly because of weakness in global markets, which is something I see in 2017. I see a deliberately weaker yen. I see a weaker renminbi, and I see a weak euro, all of which should inure to the benefit of the dollar quote. But I think that the dollar quote and gold will do relatively well in 2017. And my suspicion is that the dollar will begin to roll over in 2018, which means that I believe that the gold market will continue. So I think the important thing is the real yield in the U.S. 10-year Treasury, which is, I believe, the world's benchmark security. But I also believe that we're coming into a period where the U.S. dollar will be strong, not as a consequence really of strength in the U.S. economy, but rather as a consequence of weakness in other economies relative to the U.S. economy. And I think unusually both gold and the U.S. dollar will be well, will do well, pardon me, because I believe that past is prologue in this case. It will resemble the latter half of 1976 and the first half of 2002. Sorry for that long-winded answer, but I have fairly specific views on this.
Well, I think that's really important you mentioned that, Rick, because obviously this was the week of the standoff, if you will, between the bond greats. We had Bill Gross draw a red line in the sand saying, okay, look, 2.6 on the 10-year yield, that's it. If we go above 2.6, that means that the 35-year secular bull market in bonds is over. We have a new secular bear market in play, and that changes everything. And then the next day, Jeff Gundlach gets up on stage and says, I heard some second-tier bond manager talking about 2.6. The real number is 3.0. So the big boys are kind of poking fun at each other, but it seems clear the one thing I think they agree on, and I do too, is that there is some line in the sand someplace. If the 10-year goes above 3%, it's probably a long-lasting trend, and I would think from what you're saying, that potentially spells some pretty difficult trouble for gold prices. Am I right?
Well, you know, Eric, I wouldn't want to take on either of those two in terms of a discussion of bond markets. I would just say that if the number is 2.6 or the number is 3.0, in one sense, that's irrelevant. It's the perception of what the real yield is, that is, the yield net of the deterioration in purchasing power. And I think both of them made an important point. If you agree with the sense that the real yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury is the determinant with regards to the gold price, and if you agree that the treasuries, in fact, debt instruments themselves, have been in a bull market going all the way back to 1982, if you remember that the nominal yield on the U.S. Treasury has fallen from 15 to as low as 1.4 and now 2.4, I think you would have to agree with me that the bond market is closer to the end of a bull market than to the beginning of a bull market. If that is true, if you agree with that, it isn't too much of a leap to suggest that the gold market is closer to the beginning of a bull market than the end of a bull market. Whether or not the number is 2.4 or 3 is an entirely different set of circumstances. My suspicion is that the real yield on the Treasury will be challenged simply because, separate and apart from the narrative, we have $20 trillion in on-balance sheet liabilities at the federal level and in excess of $100 trillion real dollars in off-balance sheet liabilities. Off-balance sheet liabilities represented by people of the age of Bill Gross and Rick Rule. Those $100 trillion are allegedly real promises, and my suspicion is that we have to deal with that extraordinary debt number, $120 trillion really, at the federal level, before state and local debts, and before underfunded pension schemes. And I see only two ways out of that morass. One would be an honest default, restructuring the off-balance sheet liabilities and probably restructuring the on-balance sheet liabilities, or more likely a dishonest default where you inflate away or in some way lower the net present value of those obligations. I don't see any other way out, narrative notwithstanding. Those are real numbers. Remember, I mean, a trillion is almost incomprehensible. It is, what, 12 zeros to the right of the decimal point? It's a very large number, and it is that very number, the $120 trillion in liabilities, that tells me that the bond market, the cost of capital, is closer to the end of a bull market than it is to the beginning of a bull market, and conversely, that gold is closer to the beginning of a bull market than the end.
Well, and I think that, you know, your comments very much echo my own thoughts, which is what's going to have to happen here is we start to get into a rate normalization cycle. Inflation starts to pick up. The government has to respond to inflation by increasing interest rates in order to combat that inflation. Then you get to that point where they cannot increase interest rates because to do so would bankrupt the government because it can't service its own debt if rates go back to 6% on the 10-year. And if you get to that moment, I don't see any choice but for them to allow inflation to run away because it's the only choice available. And at that point, precious metals have got to be to the moon. Am I right about that?
I don't like inflammatory statements to the moon. But remember that precious metal prices don't have to go an awful lot higher for precious metals equities to, in fact, go to the moon. I would also point out that so many of us in the financial services business have become codependent with the Fed, and it's important to note that the Fed raised their interest rate 25 basis points, and the market raised its interest rate 100 basis points in the U.S. 10-year. At some point in time, we have to remember that markets work irrespective of the Fed. I'm not trying to say that that happens in 2017 or 2018, but time has told us, of course, particularly in extractive industries, in commodities, that markets work over time. And this sense that the grand masters, the big thinkers of the world, the Yellens, the Greenspans, the Trumps, the Obamas, are ultimately masters of over the economy, I think is a mistaken and dangerous notion.
Now, I think you and I agree very much that the 10-year is the competition for gold, and that tends to set the direction. We've had another view expressed by some of the other experts on our program. Julian Brigden in particular was outspoken in saying he thinks that the gold price is basically an anti-dollar trade. It's the opposite of the dollar index. That's what it's all about. And, of course, if that's your view, you've got to really look at Trump's policies and what they're going to mean for the dollar index. What do you think about people who take that view that it's all about the value of the dollar?
I don't think that that view is inconsistent with the U.S. 10-year Treasury. I think that the value of the U.S. 10-year Treasury is best expressed in the U.S. 10-year yield and the market's ability, the market's willingness to buy it. If the U.S. 10-year Treasury is paying you an interest rate that does not accommodate the decline in purchasing power in the dollar, then, in fact, gold does well. So I believe that both of those statements are, in fact, concurrent. I am not certain myself that Trump has the ability or the willingness, in fact, to do what would be necessary to restore a sound dollar. It's interesting to me, as an example, that he proposes to restore confidence in the dollar by restricting free trade, which, in my own opinion, has served the United States well. And it beggars, and by the way, I'm not pro-Clinton by any stretch of the imagination, but it also beggars my imagination that he plans to deal with the on-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government by spending $1.5 trillion on infrastructure, $1.5 trillion that sadly we do not have. If, on the other hand, he is successful in rolling back the morass of regulation that makes the United States a less pleasant place to do business, and if he is willing to make U.S. corporate tax rates more reflective of competitive corporate tax rates on a global basis, he could, in fact, go a long way to restoring confidence in the dollar. I'm not suspecting, given his relationship with the establishment in both the Democrat and the Republican parties, and his insults to the deep state, that he will be able to achieve those, but I would love to see it occur.
Okay, well, that, I think, is an outstanding overview of the market and market direction. Thank you for starting with that. For anyone who may want more just on the direction of the market, I know you've got a lot of information on your website at sproutglobal.com. What I'd like to do is pick up where we left off on our last interview back at the end of April, where we talked a lot about private placements in the gold and silver mining companies. And, of course, the rationale there, for anyone who didn't listen to that interview, I recommend you go back. It's still there for free on our homepage at macrovoices.com. But the whole opportunity there is, if you can get in on the ground floor of some really good junior resource companies, you've got just a tremendous leverage. As you said, a little bit of appreciation in the price of gold could take some of these companies to the moon. But boy, you've got to really have your act together in terms of the due diligence that you perform in order to pick the right ones. And I just think about this, Rick. You know, the field of due diligence on investments is pretty well understood. If you're looking at big public companies with, you know, decades of operating experience and profits and losses, and you can look at their balance sheet ratios and so forth, you can tell a lot. You're talking about companies, and I'll use that term kind of loosely, where you're really talking about smart people that have got an idea to go do something. And, you know, how does that translate? So you've said before that intellectual property is as important as physical property in exploration stage companies. What do you mean by that? And how does it play into this whole process of finding the right company to invest in?
Well, that's a really important question. people who invest in extractive industries, commodity-centric industries, always look at physical assets, an exploration property or something like that. The truth is, pre-revenue, that those assets might be more properly regarded as liabilities. They're places to spend money as opposed to places to harvest money from. And so you need to understand that in the earlier stages of the exploration business, it's really a research and development business. You're answering a series of unanswered questions about an exploration thesis wrapped around a property. When I was in university, which was almost 40 years ago, we learned that 1 in 3,000 mineralized anomalies becomes a mine. So at the beginning of the process, you actually have a 1 in 3,000 chance of being right, which is why I say that the people are more important than the assets, and the assets might more rationally be described as liabilities, excuses to spend money. It's the process of answering unanswered questions. It's the process of an evolving exploration thesis that adds value to the physical asset. And the truth is that the team's ability to select exploration targets, develop a valid exploration thesis, and both test the thesis efficiently and raise the capital to test the thesis, understanding early what constitutes failure and understanding what questions are raised by previous answers that adds value, in some cases spectacular value. It's very rare that you find an economic activity that can be as rewarding as exploration, where literally $5,000 to $7,000 drill hole can uncover a mineral deposit whose net present value, not long-term value, but net present value, can be measured in the billions. But offsetting that is the risk that most exploration efforts are ultimately unsuccessful. So it's critical that people understand the nature of the business. In its early days, it's not a physical asset business. It's an intellectual asset business. The people who choose the properties, the people who formulate the exploration thesis, and the people who test that thesis.
Well, I'm just trying to get my head around this, Rick, because I imagine, let's say there's this guy who is the absolute crackerjack, you know, Canadian Rockies gold mining guy who's never been wrong and he always gets it right. And he comes to you and he says, Rick, I need money because I've got this fantastic project in Peru. Well, wait a minute. You're dealing with a totally different culture, different government. So is the fact that this guy's really, really good at knowing the geology mean he's going to succeed there? Or does the fact that he doesn't know the culture and might not even speak Spanish, you know, a total deal killer? So how does the prospective investor investigate that intellectual property, which is oftentimes what's in people's heads? And how do you, you know, put numbers in these things and figure out what makes sense to invest in?
Well, you're heading in exactly the right direction. First of all, track record in the mining business tells you that while most teams never succeed, there are also serially successful teams. Groups of people that have been successful over three decades, a list of people that I laughingly call the A players, the serially successful people, who have been two standard deviations more successful than the median. And the first thing that it's important for investors to do is look at the teams that have historically been serially successful, who outperform the median by two standard deviations. People like the Lundin family, Swedes who have relocated to Switzerland, Robert Friedland, who has five exploration successes, world-class under his belt, my great friend Ross Beattie, Bob Quartermain, people like that. Identify yourself with teams, in particular entrepreneurs, who have been serially successful in extractive industries. The second thing, and I think you noted this in the question, is that success has to be suited to the task at hand. It's very important. You will be approached as an investor or as a financial intermediary, whatever your role is, by people who suggest to you that they have indeed been successful in mining. But it's important to note what facet of mining that success involved. As an example, if somebody's success was that they operated a gold mine in Archean ancient terrain in French-speaking Quebec, And the task at hand is that they're exploring rather than operating for copper gold rather than gold in tertiary volcanics, young rock rather than old rock, in French-speaking, in Spanish-speaking Peru rather than French-speaking Quebec. While their prior success came under the broad heading of mining, that curriculum vitae doesn't necessarily suggest that they'll be successful in the endeavor that they've chosen. So the point is that the prior success has to be very, very suited to the task at hand. And it's important in terms of doing this deep dive due diligence that in addition to the chief ego, which is what I always call the driving entrepreneur in the organization, that the CVs throughout the organization are oriented to the task at hand. Has the chief financial officer been involved in communicating with the part of the market that finances the activity that the company is involved in? If the chief financial officer's only job has been a treasury function for a producing company, he or she might not have the capabilities to arrange for the financing necessary in early stage ventures. If the exploration team themselves have been successful in a geological terrain that isn't the same as the geological terrain that they're proposing to explore now, once again, the successes on their resumes won't be suited to the task at hand. It's important to understand who the directors are, why they were chosen, and what role they are going to play. Remember that directors, ideally, form adult supervision, if you will, in early stage ventures. And it's important to know why directors were chosen, what roles they intend to play, and what about their prior history suggests that they have the expertise to fill the role that has been selected for them. Note, by the way, that many times when you ask these questions, you will find that you are dealing with a management team that has never thought through this process themselves, which is almost always a guarantee of failure. Finally, I think in early stage companies, it's important to note who the financial backers of the company are, and find out whether they have been successful in this type of endeavor in the past, whether they are, if you will, paper hangers, just stock promoters, or whether they have in fact backed companies through the stages necessary for you as a passive investor to maximize your probability of success. It's very, very important that people understand precisely the intellectual capital that's being brought to bear on the task at hand and try and decide for themselves if that intellectual capital is appropriate to the task that they have chosen for themselves. Remember that most of the planning that I'm discussing in this hasn't taken place, and probably 80% of the issuers that pollute public markets, the truth is that they have no plan, and having no plan in a process that's as risky as this is tantamount to planning for failure.
Now, you've spent almost your entire career very successfully figuring out which of these smaller companies to invest in the extraction natural resources space. So how do you see value added in these processes? What does the investor add to the process?
Yeah, this is a great question, too. Really, adding value in pre-revenue companies amounts to getting answers to a series of unanswered questions. We might have a surface anomaly that tests positive for gold and copper. And so the question might become, how broad is this surface anomaly, or what is the grade? In other words, what is the target size? Once that has been determined and you determine that the target size is large enough that it's potentially economic, it may be, does this surface anomaly extend deeper into better rocks? In other words, is there a third dimension? The third question may be, does it extend well down into bedrock where you need to drill a hole into it to determine better the third dimension? Really, the process of adding value in any research and development or intellectual capital is a series of unanswered questions, a preliminary thesis, a secondary thesis that evolves from the answer to the first question, a series really of unanswered questions that may take ultimately a decade to come to a commercial resolution. in the first analysis, what is the primary unanswered question? Many times when you ask an issuer what the primary unanswered question that they propose to address, they haven't thought of that themselves, so you can throw that company away. But assuming that the answer that they give you is good, you have to ask yourself and ask them, is that thesis supported by facts on the ground, or is it merely a convenient thesis? In other words, do you agree that the facts at hand support the question that's being asked? The next question that you might ask yourself with regards to their unanswered question is, does a yes answer have any value? As an example, some people propose to find a small mine, the idea being that they can generate cash flow from a small mine and scale up without dilution. The problem with that is that small mines have all the risks that big mines do, but small mines never make big money, which means that the thesis that they're proposing guarantees a loss for you at any rate. So you throw that one away. If you like the fact that a yes answer to a question would add enough value that it's worth putting up the money and taking the risk, then you have to examine the method by which they propose to test the thesis. Is it an intelligent method? Is it cost-effective? And will the answer that it generates, in fact, be valuable? Will they, in fact, answer the question? How much will it cost to test the question? And do they either have or have access to enough money to come up with a yes answer? If it takes a yes answer to get you value as an investor, but they don't have the money to get to a yes answer, you're doomed to failure at the very beginning of the exercise. The next question that you must ask yourself and the management team is, how long will it take to get an answer to the question? Many investors seem to have a mismatch between their investment horizon and the time it requires to get a yes answer. If two field seasons will be required to get a yes answer on an exploration project, then you have to budget 18 months before you get a yes answer. There are many investors in speculative stocks who have trauma holding stock over a long weekend. And if you have a 90-day fuse on your investment and it takes 18 months to get a yes answer, there's an immediate mismatch between your goals and reality. It's also important to know what constitutes failure. Often there are early warnings in the exploration cycle that make the ultimate success testing the thesis unlikely. It's important that you know before you put money in, and it's important that the management team knows and confirms to you what will constitute failure in answering a series of unanswered questions. So many times in my life, companies have raised $10 million to drill off a project. They've effectively killed the project after the expenditure of $3 or $4 million, but they have spent the whole $10 million rather than pivoting and saving $6 million for some way to salvage the enterprise. It's highly unlikely that this management team drilled their worst idea first. And in the absence of that, what it really means is that they wasted $6 million of your dollars. So it's important to understand and have a plan as to what constitutes failure. And then finally, it's important to understand in your mind from the management team, if they get a yes answer, what is the next question that that yes answer presupposes? And you need to make all of your investment decisions based on the information that you get answering a series of unanswered questions. If you get a no answer, obviously the reason to own the stock goes away, so you have to sell the stock. If you get a yes answer, you have to rerun the whole process. What does that yes answer presuppose in terms of the next question, and what is a yes answer on that worth? What is the probability of a yes answer? What is the cost? Does the company have the money? It's a series of unanswered questions, and it's important to understand value add in that context.
Rick, you've just laid out an extremely complete thesis for some of the decisions and so forth that go into this evaluation process. The logical question that most people would ask you is, okay, how does that translate to a specific investment strategy? But, you know, I know you to be a very introspective and honest guy. So I want to even broaden that question and say, are we headed to an investment strategy or are we headed to a speculation strategy here? Because those are very different things. Or is it both?
These are completely speculative strategies. I think that pre-revenue companies are inherently speculative, and an investor or an advisor who regards themselves as investment strategists needs to depart this session and go reread Graham and Dodd. We can talk about investments later, but this is purely strategy. This speculative strategy. This is a situation where the probability is failure, but the rewards are so extraordinary that it attracts speculators like myself. It's interesting that when I, in public lectures, make fun of speculators, my wife always laughingly says, "Yes, that's right." And Rick invests now with money that he made by speculation. So I'm not running down the speculative thing. I'm just saying that you need to understand that these are highly, highly speculative strategies.
And obviously, these are risky strategies. So you're putting a lot of time and effort, a lot of very intense energy into due diligence in something that you know that most people fail at because you feel that you've got a competitive edge where you can do a good job, pick the winners, and be successful. So why bother with all this? It seems like a very high-risk strategy. Is the reward really there to justify all of the risk that you take?
Yes, absolutely. In the first instance, you presuppose this with the question, well, you need to add both intellectual and physical capital to companies like these. In the private placement arena, as an example, you need to add equity and or debt in a structure that addresses the company's need, but also takes into account the risk associated with the investment. If the expectation is failure, you do this because the rewards for success are spectacular. It is commonplace in this business to lose 20 or 30% of the money that you have in any individual endeavor. So in the first instance, you shouldn't go into this if you're not prepared to do it 5 or 10 times. What is useful to remember is that the rewards for success are frequently 20 or 30 fold, not percent, but fold returns on capital employed. So equity investments, private placement equity investments, as an example that include warrants, generates what are really truly rewards on steroids. A 20 bagger, that is a 20 fold return on investment with a warrant, becomes a 30 or a 35 fold return on capital employed. And a 35 fold return on capital employed amortizes an awful lot of sin elsewhere in that portfolio. But that presupposes that the structure of the investment suits the issuer's need, either by way of debt, equity, or a combination of the two. And it also presupposes that the person putting up the money structures the investment well enough that there are some sweeteners, warrants in particular, that give you disproportionate rewards when you succeed against the odds. Now, for those who don't participate in private placement, for those who are aftermarket participants, you really need to understand the economic rather than the market parameters. For people who are successful speculators in pre-revenue companies, the first thing is that they have the tolerance for pain. They have a tolerance for a stock that can fall by 30 or 40% in price with no change in the economics of the task at hand, really rather a change in market's perception. So having the courage to buy companies that fall in price precipitously when there has been no news to accompany the fall is something important. The second thing is that there's a time arbitrage. Most speculators follow the thesis, got a hunch, bet a bunch, which means that they aren't particularly well-informed speculators. And the consequence of that, not having the courage of their convictions, is that they have a 60 to 90 day time frame in what is an 18 to 60 month process. Understanding the nature of the business and utilizing your capital, paying attention to economic rather than narrative perspectives, is the way that you out-compete your competitors. Also, remember that in the whole process, there are often exit opportunities before failure. Many times in my career, I have put money into a company that has doubled or tripled in a good market in anticipation of a yes answer before the yes answer has occurred. There's nothing in the world quite as much fun as doing a financing at a dollar with a warrant at $1.50 and seeing a $3 market before you have got a yes answer or a no answer. That gives you the ability to sell down some of your stake, take your risk capital off the table, and have a free ride with the balance of your equity and your warrants. Similarly, if you get a no answer in this whole process, then the strategy is almost irrespective of the market price, you sell it. If your reason to own the company goes away, that is, if the probability of the yes answer becomes highly, highly, highly unlikely, it's important to take a 20% loss or a 30% loss before it becomes a 70% loss or a 100% loss. The good news about all this is that you are competing with other speculators who haven't thought through the process at all. In other words, you are competing with people who are psychologically and intellectually disarmed at the very beginning of the fight. One of the attractions to this business is that the caliber of your competition is so low that if you do the work and prepare yourself, your odds of succeeding are actually fairly high.
So translating this, obviously, for our institutional listeners, you know, one option that's available to them is to let you do all of this work for them and invest through one of your funds. I'll give you a chance to plug that at the end of the interview. But for now, I want to focus on what's realistic. If you are, let's say, we have people who are either family offices or very sophisticated individual investors who spend most of their time managing their investments and are very interested in precious metals and mining, is it realistic for an individual private investor to really be plugged in and engaged in this market space and, you know, competing shoulder to shoulder with guys like you? Or do you have a monopoly on this? You know, how do people get involved, and how realistic is it for individual investors? It sounds like on the one hand, you're saying you've got guys like you that are very good at it, but there's probably a larger number of guys who have no clue what they're doing who are also in this space. So, you know, is this something that's advisable for a serious private investor who's spending a lot of their time managing their investments?
I think a serious private speculator can do very well in this space because the space is so emotional and because it requires contrarian thinking. Gretzky famously said he became a great hockey player not by skating to where the puck was, but to where he thought the puck was going to be. And the truth is that you need to speculate both as a professional or as a private amateur in a contrarian fashion. You have to invest in natural resource sectors that are out of favor, not in favor. And secondly, you'll be competing mostly with people who are much less rigorous in the process. In terms of operating successfully in the space, I would suggest that you have to devote minimally somewhere between sort of $200,000 and $250,000 to the process. You have to be ready over the course of a year and a half to make, say, $10,000-$25,000 investments in a broad range of speculative attempts. And you have to be willing to spend sort of an hour a month per position studying the companies that you have in your portfolio. If you aren't willing to devote sort of $250,000 and 10 hours a month, you should not be in the sector. You will not be able to compete with me. If you are willing to do that, it has been a truly spectacular sector for the few of us who, you know, devote the time and treasure to the sector that it demands. So I would recommend it. I mean, among other things, it becomes an awful lot of fun. What young child male or female, hasn't been seduced by the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The process is both fun and profitable for those of us who take the time and do the work.
That's about all I can think of in terms of questions, Rick, but I know since you're a very insightful guy, I want to turn it around. What question did I forget? What did I leave out? Is there some secret sauce to doing this?
Yeah, I think there is, and the secret sauce really is contrarian strategies. You know, commodities are extraordinarily cyclical and extraordinarily volatile. And one of the secrets to my success over the last 30 years has been that I look where the market isn't. An example right now would be, you know, in the copper market or the energy market, the uranium market, or the agricultural minerals markets. Markets where, in fact, the selling price of the commodity on a global basis is less than the cost of production. Now, what that means is that either the selling price of the commodity has to increase, or society will do without a commodity that is necessary for our standard of living, which is a de facto way of saying the commodity price is going to increase. But when industries are in liquidation, when the selling price of the product is less than the cost of production, when you know that the price of the commodity has to go up, you don't know when, but you know that it has to go up, the competition for high-quality investments and speculations is the least. So in extractive industries, at least, you must be a contrarian or you absolutely will be a victim. Take advantage of equity market and commodity market cyclicality and volatility. Remember that these shares can fall 20 or 30% in price simply because one institutional investor had some redemptions. If nothing has changed in the value of the company, but the price of the company has gone down by 20 or 30%, use that as an opportunity to buy more stock. Similarly, if a company has gone up 20 or 30% in price for no reason whatsoever other than perhaps they had a good marketing tour to London or Geneva, use that as the opportunity to sell a little stock and reduce your basis in the rest. Be a contrarian or you will be a victim.
Well, Rick, we're almost out of time. I want to ask, though, for serious investors, people who are really into this, I've heard of some investors signing up for, I think it's the Colorado School of Mining. What if you really want to be in this space as a private investor or, say, a family office manager who really wants to be expert in this? What's the learning path? What do you do in order to become an expert?
Well, this is a bit self-serving, but our own website, www.sproutglobal.com, has in excess of 200 hours of instructional material. I guarantee your subscribers will get their money's worth because it's absolutely free. As an example, we have 50 hours of the Mining Investment College, which I did together with the Colorado School of Mines in the mid-1990s. The material is dated, but it's still very, very useful. The Colorado School of Mines sold it for $1,000 a course. It's yours for free. So begin by boning up on the free material that's available. The second thing is that people really need to decide if they, A, can afford psychologically and physically to be speculators as opposed to investors. Do a psychological audit on yourself. But if the answer is yes, understand that as a speculator, cyclical, volatile sectors like resources are truly the best place to be. Use money that you can afford substantial losses on and understand that you need to be in the sector for a cycle, which is probably 5 years. Think about an amount of money that you want to devote for 5 years with the risk of substantial loss, and think about spending a minimum of 10 hours per month getting yourself up to speed. At that point in time, it's time to start. And you start by determining which sectors that you think are out of favor that will return to favor because there's ongoing demand for the commodity. The second thing that you do is determine management teams that are active in that sector who have been successful, serially successful in that and related sectors over periods of time. When you've done those two things, well, really three things, the psychological audit on yourself to understand if you can stomach speculation, cyclicality, and volatility, if you have identified sectors that you think are deeply out of favor that will return to favor, and you have identified management teams that have been successful in that in the past, you have overcome probably 70% of the obstacles to success.
And finally, for those who would be more comfortable hiring your expertise to help them with these kind of investments, why don't we look at three different audiences? One is the institutional audience, which for these speculative strategies is probably going to be family offices and smaller institutions. The next is high net worth private investors. And then the final audience would be retail investors who are not able to participate in accredited investor-only offerings. For each of those three audiences, tell us what you do at Sprott Global and how you might be able to help them.
Well, for institutional investors and large family offices, we have a variety of institutional products. We have Natural Resource Lending Fund, as an example, with about $400 million in assets that makes bridge and mezzanine loans on behalf of ourselves. We're the largest, by the way, Sprott is the largest investor in its own self-managed fund, but we manage for some very large institutions in that space. We also manage private equity for large Asian investors in the infrastructure and resource processing sector. But we have a variety of institutional products, debt and equity in the natural resource space. And we're always interested in doing segregated accounts or co-investing with large institutional partners. It's worthy to note, by the way, that at Sprott, we employ about $320 million of our own capital, and we co-invest in virtually every structure that we originate. For high net worth individuals, there are really two different ways to participate with us. We, from time to time, offer up bespoke partnerships where we do this on your behalf. And in these partnerships, I am usually the general partner, and I always invest in 10% of the partnership units with my own money. I eat my own cooking because I think it's the right thing to do, and also over time, it's generally tasted good. The second thing that we could do is set up a segregated account for high net worth individuals so that they could participate on an individual basis under our guidance. Retail investors who are not accredited really have two choices. Well, three choices, I should say. The first thing is that they could open a direct brokerage account with us where they manage their own money, but they do it under our guidance. We give them the ideas, they say yes or no, or we pull the trigger. A more passive approach for retail investors who are interested in the gold equity space or in physical precious metals is that Sprott has five New York Stock Exchange traded products especially for them. We have physical trusts that own physical precious metals in the gold, silver, and platinum and palladium spaces traded on the New York Stock Exchange, which is a tax-efficient and low-effort way to own precious metals. And we also have two exchange-traded funds, the Sprott Gold Miners Index and the Sprott Junior Gold Miners Index, which are passive products, but they're factors-based. In other words, not market capitalization-based, like the larger alternatives that exist. And those are very low-effort and also low-fee ways for people to participate in the precious metals equity markets, which I think will be a good place to be in the next 5 years. The final way for anybody to participate is that Sprott Inc., the parent company, is publicly listed. We trade under the symbol SII in Canada or SPOXF. We manage about $11 billion on behalf of a couple hundred thousand investors worldwide. We have $325 million in working capital with no debt, so we're extremely well financed. And at current equity prices, we pay about a 5% dividend. So one thing that you could do is be extremely passive and simply own us and enjoy rent on your money while we employ other people's money in what I think will be a pretty nice natural resource market over the next 5 years.
Well, Rick, I cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview. I can always count on you to go, you know, off the chart from the usual garden variety gold and silver interview. And of course, for any listeners who are looking for that garden variety interview, the place to check out is Rick's website at sprottglobal.com, where you can find all kinds of information about precious metals and other resource strategies. We're going to have to end it there. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Great interview, Eric.
Well, thanks, Aaron, but I really, really want to thank you deeply because this is going to be your last program as co-host and producer. You have done such a fantastic job. I never could have gotten Macro Voices to this point without first the contributions of Nathan Egger, who helped to launch the show, and everything that you've done since in terms of helping to grow the program. So finally, I think I'm finally allowed, with all the secrecy of your new organization, to tell our listeners you have begun an exciting new career with Real Vision. You're actually speaking to us from Real Vision Towers in the Cayman Islands today. So please tell us what you're going to be doing for Real Vision. We can't wait.
Well, Eric, it's been a great experience, and I want to thank you, personally for the opportunity to work alongside you and to showcase some of the smartest people in finance week after week. It's been great. To the listeners, thank you again for your support, and it's been a real pleasure to be along with you for the journey. We're in such unprecedented economic, financial, and geopolitical times, and quite frankly, the mainstream media, financial or otherwise, is failing us in more ways than one. So working on a project like Macro Voices brought me tremendous gratification because of the opportunity to provide an alternative to other people. So it's been great. Eric, to your question about what I'll be doing at Real Vision, it's really still under wraps, but you are persistent, I'll give you that. I'm ecstatic to work for Real Vision, and when the opportunity came up in October, and after having spoken with Raul and Grant, it really was a no-brainer for me. These guys and the whole team, really, they're doing something really special, and I'm pumped to do my part to bring truth back to finance. So, Eric, so many of our guests have talked about how we're in uncharted territory, and it could not be a worse time for finance to be treated and produced as entertainment. And, as I said earlier, big media is failing us left, right, and center. So I've railed on this topic on Twitter. And the flip side of this is that, there is a tremendous opportunity to fill this sort of truth vacuum. And this is exactly what we're doing. Real Vision has launched two products, television and most recently publications, as you know, which is actually tremendous value given the caliber of research and analysis. And there's much more to come. So, Eric, I'm excited and humbled by the opportunity, and I hope the listeners will join me on this journey.
Well, and I want to personally and publicly thank Raul Paul, your new boss, too, because Raul has been a perfect gentleman. He knew when he hired you. Obviously, I'm not going to stand in the way of you pursuing a much more strategic career opportunity, but he knew it would put me in a really difficult spot to lose you suddenly. And he has been a perfect gentleman about making you available on his payroll to continue to host Macro Voices with me until I could find a replacement who will indeed be starting next week. So, Raul, if you're listening, I really want to tell you how much I appreciate it. But at the same time, we got to get tough with this new boss of yours, Aaron, because we want to know what you're working on. So I know you've got him scheduled, and I know he wants to promote Real Vision some more. So you tell him for me that next time he's on the program, we have ways of making him talk. He's not going to get his interview unless he tells us what you're working on. Okay.
Well, to be honest, Eric, I'm quite surprised we were able to get him on at all, given how much he's traveling and all the people he's speaking with. But Eric, as you said, we're in luck, and you can ask him next week what I'm up to.
Oh, you're giving away who our guest is for next week. Okay. Well, we will definitely be pressing Raul to tell us more. I know that I'm probably not supposed to announce it, but I think Real Vision has at least a half a dozen disruptive new business plans of things that they want to do to change the face of financial media. And I think it's exciting, and I intend to press Mr. Paul to talk about as many of them as we can get him to on next week's show. So other than that, I just can't thank you enough, and I wish you the very best in your new career.
Thanks, Eric. So, Eric, anything else to add before we move on?
Well, I will. Of course, the show must go on. I will be back with a brand new producer and co-host. Since you gave away who the guest is for next week, I guess we'll keep it a secret who the producer and co-host is going to be. But I'm really excited about the direction that we're going to take the show. And, of course, as I always say, we really need your help, folks, promoting the show. Tell your friends about it. Forward your research roundup to your colleagues. The more people that are listening, the better of a job that we can do in recruiting the very best featured interviews. guests. So retweet us when we announce the show, and most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. When you do that and give us your email address, we will automatically send you the research roundup email, which is completely free and includes a compendium of the very best free stuff that we could find on the internet each week, along with any links to supporting documentation, presentations, graphs, charts, so forth, that our featured interview guests may be referring to in the interviews. All of that is free. All you have to do is sign up at macrovoices.com, and the more registered users we have, the better we can do at getting the very best guests. So, Aaron, your last time with your famous show wrap, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, we've got another listener-heavy contribution this week, so thanks again to all of those of you who contributed, and a special shout-out to Danny Esposito. You've been flooding my inbox with articles, and really appreciate it. We have the latest investment outlook from Bill Gross and some excellent articles from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard from The Telegraph. You know, I love the way he doesn't pull any punches and is one of the few mainstream journalists I actually respect. So you'll find all this and much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at MacroDidact. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. This has been a great experience, and thanks for everything.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.